Thank you, Hayden. What a great song. Maybe I should not talk. We should just sing that song a couple more times. Well, that was such a wonderful song. I'm certainly grateful to be here today. Sorry, Shane, that I get to be here today. But at least Vicky got through nursing school just in time. We are sorry that he's been injured, and hope for him a very quick recovery. It is great to be together. It's good to be together on Mother's Day or any other day. I can tell I'm going to have trouble. I'm one of these people who just stick stuff in their Bibles, and then I get up here and it all falls out. So if anything falls on the floor, I'm not going to pick it up unless it's the notes I'm using, in which case I'll pick them up. But it's good to be together. I always think on Mother's Day. This was sort of a special year anniversary in my family. Back in November was the 50th anniversary of my mother's death. I know you're thinking, he doesn't look like he could be 50 years old, but we are, aren't we, Tom? And several more. Tom and I grew up together, but 50 years, that's hard to believe. When I was growing up, there used to be a tradition. I don't see this as much anymore, but everyone wearing roses. Some of us have on roses today, wearing roses on Mother's Day. And if your mother was not living, you wore a white rose. And so I sort of grew up always wearing white roses. But our mothers are certainly special and precious to us. You know, if you're going to have a Mother's Day sermon, you could pick lots of mothers. We could have Eve, who was the mother of all. You could have Sarah. You could have Moses' mother, Samuel's mother. That's always popular. Samuel's mother is always a popular one. You could go to the New Testament and, of course, have Mary. You might have Timothy's mother or grandmother. But I'm not going to talk about any of them. How about Jezebel? That would be different. Yeah. Nobody ever talks about Jezebel on Mother's Day. Or maybe her daughter Athaliah, who perhaps was even more wicked than she was. Athaliah doesn't get as much press as Jezebel. Her story is a little shorter as it's told to us, but Athaliah may have been even worse than Jezebel. Nobody talks about them for some reason. And to tell you the truth, I'm not going to talk about them today either. But I am going to mention them because I don't really have a Mother's Day sermon specifically. To have had a really specific Mother's Day sermon, Shane would have had his emergency before 9 o'clock Friday night. But I am going to start talking with Jezebel. Actually, I wasn't kidding about that. But hopefully say some things that will be applicable not only to our mothers, but to everyone. But it is going to be based on an Old Testament story, which really sort of begins with Jezebel. And Jezebel, obviously, is a rather infamous character, along with her sniveling husband, Ahab. I just think of him as just sort of a sniveling weasel, Jezebel was the force in that relationship, and he was just kind of whimpering in the background a lot of the time, it seemed to me. But it was a remarkable time in the history of Israel, where not only did the people just sort of drift away from God, they were actively led away from God by their leaders. So it wasn't an accident. It wasn't just something that happened over time. But Ahab and Jezebel actively and purposefully led people away from God. And they promoted idol worship. It said that there were 450 prophets of Baal who were on the payroll. They were directly supported. It said they ate at Jezebel's table. So we have a case of the leaders actively promoting idolatry and causing people to turn away from God. In this setting, there's a prophet named Elijah. It was really a tough time to be a prophet of God. When you have the leadership actively promoting idolatry, then where does that leave a prophet of God? He's automatically directly opposed to his own government when he tries to speak for God. And he was enormously unpopular with Ahab and Jezebel because he was, was always opposed to them. Whatever they were doing, obviously he was going to be opposed to it. And they just saw him as a tremendous thorn in their sides. There came a time when Elijah decides to openly confront them and challenge them, which again was just kind of an interesting thing to think about. If you were going to just openly challenge and confront the king and queen of your country, and basically call them out in front of everybody. And he does that by challenging their prophets. And so you remember there was a great contest between Elijah and the 450 prophets of Baal, along with another 400 prophets of Asherah, who's sort of the female counterpart in the idol world, sort of the female counterpart to Baal, the male idol. And so he has this great contest with the prophets, Elijah does. And they meet on a mountaintop in kind of a remote area and have this big challenge where Elijah lets them go first. And basically the idea is we'll set up altars, we'll set up sacrifices, but there will be no fire put on the sacrifice. And the real God will be the God who answers with fire and burns up the sacrifice. And so the prophets of Baal went first, and didn't go real well for them. They spent all day long trying to get Baal to send down fire and burn up their sacrifice. And of course, it didn't happen. And then late in the afternoon, Elijah has his turn, and he does pray to God, who does send down fire from heaven and burns up the sacrifice. So this is really sort of the high point of Elijah's career. Here he has challenged the king and his wicked wife, and he's challenged all these prophets of Baal who are on the royal payroll, and he has won. He won. You know, so you would think he would be very, very excited about this, and I guess he was at some level, that he won. He publicly humiliated the king who was leading in this idol worship. And so he goes back to town. The king goes back to town. When the king gets back to town, he tells Jezebel what's happened. And Jezebel is, in fact, she's humiliated. So, you know, she's probably mad at Ahab, did I mention he was a sniveling weasel? She's mad at Ahab that he let this happen. But she's most of all mad at Elijah, who has publicly humiliated her and her prophets. And so she sends a message to Elijah. And the message is very clear and very simple and very, very, probably pretty short. The message is, tomorrow this time you'll be dead. That's the message. That tomorrow by this time you will be like the prophets of Baal, who had all been killed, by the way, at the end of the contest. Tomorrow this time you'll be the same as them. I think Elijah's reaction to this is very interesting. You would think that he might say, you know, in your face, lady, I just whipped you and your people. You know, I just won. You must have just missed what happened. I just won. But that's not what he does. When she says, tomorrow this time you'll be dead, he believed her. And he ran for his life. Literally. He literally starts running. Literally. Runs out of town and heads south. There was some safety in going south because, if you remember at this time, there were two countries, Israel and Judah. Israel's the northern part where all this happened. Judah is south. So he doesn't have to go very far to be out of the country, and actually in a different country from Israel to Judah. So he heads south. But he doesn't just go a little bit south. He runs, 100 miles or so before he stops the first time. And he lays down under a little scrubby tree and goes to sleep, basically in the desert. And he wakes up and an angel is poking him. That would be a little unusual. And the angel has prepared food for him and tells him to eat and drink. He's in the desert. Angel gives him something to drink. I'm in 1 Kings chapter 19, by the way. I should have said that earlier. And the angel, you know, says, you need to eat and drink. And so Elijah does eat and drink and then goes back to sleep again. It's interesting. I think that's interesting. People sleep for a lot of reasons. You do need to sleep, by the way. We need to. Sometimes people sleep because they're discouraged, or they sleep because they're depressed, or they sleep for escape. And I wonder, you know, and Elijah no doubt was exhausted, but I just wonder about this persistent sleep he was in. But he does finally get up again, and he heads south some more. He's already gone, you know, 100 miles south or so. He's going to go at least another 100 miles south on foot, all the way down into the Sinai Peninsula, all the way down to Mount Sinai itself. That is a long way. Remember how long it took the Israelites to do that? 40 years. Of course, they did a lot of wandering. It wasn't a 40-day trip. But he's on a 40-day trip down south to Sinai. And he finds a cave and basically just crawls in a cave. And it's just, so there he is, the prophet of God. He's gone 200 miles south on foot to a mountain, finds a cave, and crawls in it. I just think that's interesting. You know, a lot of times we feel like that sometimes, but Elijah actually did it. You know, just to run away, find a cave, crawl in it, and what's next? I don't know what he thought was going to happen next, but all he knows is he's just going to crawl off in a cave. And so at that point, God speaks to him. I love God's first statement. The first thing God says to him in verse 9 of chapter 19 of 1 Kings is, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" It's kind of, ask kind of the obvious, "What are you doing here?" Oh, Elijah says, "Well, I got to tell you what's happened." He said, "I've tried so hard. I've been very zealous for you, Lord," he says. And the sons of Israel have forsaken you. Do you know what's happened, God? They have turned against you. I always thought that was kind of interesting. Like God was going to go, "Really? I didn't know that. They have turned against you. And they have torn down your altars." Have you seen? They've tore your altars down. "And they killed all the prophets except me. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me." Boy, he's just having a pity party, isn't he? He is just, thinks God should be having one too. And so he was told to go outside his cave, that God was going to come and meet with him. And so we have this famous story where the first thing that happens, it says that the Lord was passing by. It said that first, there was a tremendously strong wind. A wind so strong, it says, that it was breaking rocks in pieces. You know, we have just, as has been mentioned this morning already, have just been through quite a natural disaster in our area. Over in Columbia, we clung to the banks of the Duck River and kept from getting washed away over there. And of course, Nashville is very heavily damaged. Sally's two children were flooded, their house flooded. They share a duplex in Nashville. Last Sunday morning, Jennifer went to get up, swung her legs out of bed, and splashed into her bedroom floor. She's a good sleeper. So she literally swung out of bed and put her feet in water. Didn't realize that their house had water in it until then. But anyway, we've just been reminded of the power of nature over the last few days. And so here Elijah faces just this incredibly howling wind. It's actually moving boulders. But that wasn't God. God wasn't in the wind. And then after the wind, there was an earthquake. And again, we've been reminded in recent weeks and months of the powers of earthquakes, with the earthquake in Chile and the earthquake in Haiti, and just what incredible forces those are. And what a demonstration of the power of God that could be, that God can shake the earth. And so there's an earthquake, but then we're told, but that wasn't God. God wasn't in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, there was a fire, but God wasn't in the fire. So you can imagine Elijah standing there bracing himself as this horrendous wind comes, this gale force wind, and then an earthquake happens. And then he's surrounded by fire, and he must have been thinking, what next? And after the fire, he hears just a small, gentle sound. The King James says a still, small voice. The New American Standard says the sound of a gentle blowing. And that's God. And God gently speaks to Elijah. And Elijah kind of comes out of his cave, wrapped in his mantle, his scarf. And he goes out to the entrance of the cave. And this gentle voice of God says to him exactly what it had said before. The voice says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah says exactly the same thing he said before. It's recorded word for word the same. "I've been jealous for the Lord. And Israel's forsaken thy covenant and torn down thy altars and killed all the prophets with the sword, and I'm the only one left, and they seek to kill me, to take me away." And then God responds in an interesting way. I think it's interesting that God spoke to Elijah gently. He didn't scold him, didn't yell at him, didn't fuss at him. You know, Elijah didn't need the wind. He didn't need the earthquake. He didn't need the fire. He had already beaten himself up. He didn't need God to beat him up. He needed understanding. He needed at that point someone to be gentle with him. You know, and we have times like Elijah. You know, times when everything goes wrong, when my best efforts are not enough, when I've got too much to do and not enough time to get it done in. Times when my faith is weak, when I try to share my faith with other people and it doesn't go well. I try to do what I think God would want me to do and it doesn't get the response that I would think it should get. And times when we would just like to run away. You know, there are times when we can identify with David when he wrote in Psalm 55, "Oh, that I had the wings of a dove, that I could fly away and be at rest." Sometimes we have the feeling it'd be nice if a hole would open up and we could drop through the floor. Or sometimes it would be nice if you just have this feeling of, I have got to get out of here, whatever the situation is. Or just the feeling, boy, if only I had wings, I would flap them and be gone. And we feel like that we just don't need anybody else to yell at us. We don't need anybody to fuss at us. We don't need someone getting on to us. And in those times, God is there. Not saying, "What is the matter with you, Elijah? What in the world are you doing here? Have you lost your mind? Do you know where you are?" Didn't fuss at him. Just gently asked him, first of all, "What are you doing here?" Or in other words, said to Elijah, "Look at yourself. Look at yourself, Elijah. What are you doing here? What are you doing? How did you get in this shape that you're in? You know, how did it come to this? What is the situation exactly?" Because it turns out Elijah had misread his situation. It was actually not as bad as he thought. Now, he did have some very serious problems. He was facing some very serious situations. But he had misread what the situation actually was. Plus, had he forgotten what happened the day before he ran? Isn't it interesting how life kind of has ups and downs? You know, about the time I think things are going great, you know, then the bottom falls out somehow. And that's what had happened to Elijah. He had just had this great moment in his life, this contest with the prophets of Baal. I mean, talk about being on a high. He had stood down, faced basically a whole nation from its leadership on down, and won. And the very next day, it just all comes crashing down. The very next day, he's running for his life. So, you know, how quickly we forget sometimes. You know, often our lives are made up of whatever's happening right now, whatever's going on today. And I forget that sometimes there's a bigger picture than just what's going on right now. And Elijah sort of lost the big picture. And all he could see was today, things are horrible. And he continued to focus on that over weeks afterwards. You would think at some point it would have kicked in to Elijah, "That was scary that she threatened me. But man, that was cool there at Mount Carmel. That was great. Man, that was really great." But he seems to have never gone back to that. For the next 6 weeks, he just focused on the bad day. And that led him to run and run and run farther and farther away. So that God could say to Elijah, "Whoa, wait a minute. What are you doing here? What happened? You know, that you've only focused on the one bad day." So that's the first thing God said to him. Basically a question. What are you doing here? Asking Elijah to look at himself, to look at his own situation a little more realistically. The second thing God would say to Elijah as the story unfolds, and it's actually the third thing he says to it, but I'm going to use it second, is, "You are not alone." See, Elijah had said, "I'm alone. I'm the only one. I'm the only one left." And God would say to Elijah, "No, you're not. You're you're not the only one left. It may feel like you're the only one left. You may feel all alone, but you're not all alone. And he was not alone in two ways. First and most important was that God was with him. Repeatedly through the stories of the Scriptures, we find people who are alone at particular moments, and God reminds them that they are not alone, and not as alone as it might look. As Jacob was running for his life from Esau, and he's camped out, what may have been the first night, he's camped out, heading on a long trip, and he's basically sleeping out under the stars, and God comes to him and says, "Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go. You're not alone." God would speak to Moses when Moses was very much alone on Mount Sinai in the beginning when God first called him. And God said to him, "I will be with you, and I will meet you on this mountain again." David knew. David could write those famous words, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." Why? Because David's a great warrior? No, he will fear no evil, for thou art with me, because God was with him. You know, even Jesus faced physical aloneness. As Jesus was facing his own death, he said to his apostles, "Behold, an hour is coming, and has already come, for you to be scattered, and each to his own home, and to leave me alone. And yet, I am not alone, for the Father is with me." So Elijah was not alone, first of all, and we are not alone, because God is with us. But even beyond that, he wasn't alone anyway. I mean, he's alone at the moment. He's run away. He's holed up in a cave. But God said, "Oh, there's 7,000 others. There's 7,000 who have not bowed to Baal. You're not as alone as you think you are." You know, there are times when our perception, our perspective is, you know, it's me against the world. You know, nobody cares. Nobody seems to care. Nobody's care. You know, and God would remind us, not only is he with us, but, you know, we're probably not as alone as it feels like we are. The other thing that God said to him is, I got things I need you to do. There's still work to be done, Elijah. And it's interesting that when Elijah complains that he's alone and that nobody, you know, God, nobody cares about you anymore. They've torn the idols down. God doesn't argue with him about that. He just says, "Okay, whatever. I got stuff I need you to do. Now listen closely and we'll give you some jobs." And God gives him three things to do. He says, "I want you to go anoint Hazael as king of Syria." That's not even his country. "I want you to go into a neighboring country and anoint a king." I'll come back to that in a second. He says, "I want you to anoint another guy who's going to be king down the road in Israel." That was his country. He won't be the king right after Ahab. He's going to be two or three kings later. But God's thinking ahead. He wants Elijah to think ahead a little bit here. Let's get out of the cave. Let's think ahead. And so I got something else I want you to do. And then the third thing he said, and also, I want you to go pick and begin training your successor. This is where we're introduced to Elisha. I want you to go find a man named Elisha and get him to come with you, and you're going to train him to take your place. God says, "I've got work for you to do." So while God doesn't fuss at him and God doesn't scold him for running away, God is also not going to let him just sit in a cave either. You know, "Elijah, I've got stuff to do." It's kind of interesting. The first thing he told him to do, to anoint Hazael, king of Syria, he told him to go to Damascus, the capital of Syria, and anoint Hazael king. Okay, that's 300 miles away back the way he came. That's retrace the 200 miles that you came down here, and then there's going to be another 100 miles north. So it's 300 miles the opposite direction. That kind of reminds you of the story of Jonah, where, you know, God's direction was kind of the opposite of Jonah's direction. And so he gives him, you know, work to do. You know, there are times when we feel alone, we feel helpless, we feel hopeless, and we have to remember that there's still work to be done. God still has things for us to do. It's often true that when we're down and discouraged, and I mean, kind of by definition, we're thinking about ourselves, we tend to be thinking about ourselves. And that often through doing things for others, whether it be visiting at Morning Point or any number of other things that we might do that get us outside of ourselves and out of our caves, then sure enough, we find that things are not quite as bleak as they had appeared to be. You know, the same God who spoke to Elijah in a gentle voice watches over you and me. He sees our problems and He cares about us. Peter encouraged us to cast our cares and anxieties on Him because He cares for us. The God that told Elijah, "Look at yourself, you're not alone, and I have work for you to do," would say those same things to us. God is not waiting to blow us away with a strong wind, to crack our world open with an earthquake, or to blast us with fire. But God speaks gently to us and encourages us to come to Him, to follow Him, to obey Him. This morning, if you're not a Christian, He speaks gently to you. If you are a Christian and have wandered away, you might need yelling at, but there's also a good chance you just need to be gently reminded that God loves you and encourages you to come back to Him. If we could help you, encourage you, we'd ask you to come as we stand together and sing.